a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. Now, I know that I said on Monday's program that Cody Wisniewski would be with us from Firearms Policy Coalition's Action Foundation. Unfortunately, Cody had a scheduling issue come up, so we're going to get him on the program hopefully next week, which will be the next time that I have a chance to do another Bearing Arms Cam and Company. I'm going to be off for the next few days. I will inform you that my colleagues will be holding down the fort at BearingArms.com, so I encourage you to continue visiting the website to learn more about the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. Now, fortunately, or unfortunately, as the case may be, there's still plenty to talk about on today's show, including a new study out at the Journal of the American Medical Association that purports to take a look at the implementation of Colorado's red flag law since it went into effect in 2020. KRDO in Colorado headlined their coverage this way: new data reveals difference in approval rate of red flag petitions among Colorado counties. Interestingly, KRDO also describes the phrase red flag law as controversial, even though they use the phrase in their headline. As bad as that is, the study that they're writing about is even worse. And it starts with the premise, right? Starts with the premise that red flag laws are not just legal, but that they're valuable, that they are worthwhile. And so, of course, if you believe that, then the number of red flag petitions that are filed, well, the higher the number, the better, right? The higher the number of petitions granted, the better. And that's not really the case. Hey, again, if you're concerned about the constitutionality of these red flag laws, violating due process, violating Second Amendment rights, violating 14th Amendment rights, you know, you may have a very different perspective on what these numbers would show. And in fact, I think that is the case for me, and I'm guessing for you as well. So we're going to dive into this a little bit. The study itself was called Petitions for Extreme Risk Protection Orders and Second Amendment Sanctuary Status in Colorado. Basically, the authors of this study wondered, what are these circumstances under which extreme risk protection orders have been used in counties that have made political proclamations against their use, i.e. Second Amendment sanctuary counties? What they found is that since 2020, and this, they only looked at 2020, 2021, and 2022, so they didn't look at last year's red flag petitions, but they found that there were 338 extreme risk protection order petitions that were filed across the state, 37.3% of which they say were filed in Second Amendment sanctuaries, with 31.7% of those petitions made by law enforcement. Cases, they say, included respondents with serious mental health and or substance abuse problems, histories of interaction with police, and threats of mass violence, violence against specific others, against law enforcement, and suicide. And they say when compared with ERPO petitions filed in non-2A sanctuary counties, those from sanctuaries were less likely to have been petitioned for by law enforcement, as well as less likely to be granted. Now, first of all, it doesn't surprise me that we would see fewer red flag petitions filed in these Second Amendment sanctuary counties, both because of the inherent skepticism over these laws, but also simply because the population of these non-sanctuary counties is going to be higher, right? More people are living in Denver than in, let's say, Douglas County. Or El Paso County, both of which have sizable populations, but are still going to pale in comparison, right? And then when you get into the really rural counties in Colorado, you may be talking about, you know, 15, 20,000 people in a particular county, which is the size of, you know, a neighborhood in Denver, Colorado. So we would expect that there would be more red flag petitions filed in non-2A counties. What it really interests me is the rate of approval for red flag petitions in counties that have declared their support for the Second Amendment by, you know, passing resolutions proclaiming themselves to be Second Amendment sanctuaries, versus those like Denver, where you've got a local government that is incredibly hostile to your right to keep and bear arms. According to these studies' authors, during the study period, 353 ERPO petitions were filed across Colorado. 96 in 2020, 104 in 2021, and 153 in 2022. Among these petitions, they say 126 were filed in 20 of the state's 37 sanctuary counties. The remaining 17 2A sanctuary counties did not have any ERPOs filed during the study period. 61 of these petitions from 2A sanctuary counties resulted in emergency orders. So 61 out of, 127 or so, 126? So about half of those petitions in sanctuary counties resulted in emergency orders, 40 of which led to full one-year extreme risk protection orders after a hearing. ERPO petitions in non-2A sanctuaries were both more likely to be petitioned for by law enforcement, about 65% in non-sanctuary counties versus roughly 32% in sanctuary counties, and to have been granted a temporary extreme risk protection order 78% of the time in non-sanctuary counties compared to 48.4% of the time in sanctuary counties. They also say that ERPOs have been filed in 2A sanctuaries against individuals for threats of suicide only 7.8% of the time. Targeted violence against family members or law enforcement, 92.2% of the red flag cases in those sanctuary counties. And for threatening mass violence, i.e. threatening to shoot three or more people, that accounted for 17.5%. Now, you will know that that adds up to more than 100%, right? So it seems like in many cases, you had threats against family members, as well as threats against the public, or threats of self-harm, as well as threats against the public. Now, again, according to the study's authors, this indicates that there's a problem in these sanctuary counties, right? Not only are fewer petitions filed by law enforcement, but fewer petitions are granted by a judge. And when we talk about these temporary extreme risk protection orders, that's basically the ex parte hearing, right? That's the hearing where you don't know what's taking place. You don't know that a petition's been filed. You don't get to present your side of the story. It is a very one-sided interview, basically, with a judge. And a judge decides whether or not they have a reasonable belief that you pose a danger to yourself or others. If a judge determines that that's the case, then the temporary order is granted. Your firearms are seized. And 14 days later, you come back for a full hearing on the one-year petition if prosecutors choose to move forward with that. That is the first time that you get the opportunity to weigh in. And again, it's not like you're innocent until proven guilty, right? This is not a criminal proceeding. This is a civil proceeding. So that adage doesn't apply. You are, in fact, considered dangerous at that point unless you can prove otherwise. So what I find really interesting about this is that, again, it's not just how many cases are being filed, right? You would expect Denver is going to have more than Durango or, a small town on the Western Slope. But when you look at the rates of approval, 78% of these ex parte hearings for a temporary, that first step, right, that 14-day deprivation of your rights, 78% of those are approved in non-sanctuary counties. Less than half of those petitions are approved in sanctuary counties. Again, to the study's authors, this indicates that there's something at issue in these 2A sanctuary counties, right? Whereas to me, my question becomes, are these temporary restraining orders being rubber stamped in many cases in more liberal locales like Denver? You stand a much better chance of having a temporary petition approved if you file it in one of those counties than if you file it in a place where, again, the opposition to these laws have already been vocalized by local officials. I'm concerned about this. Not because I think that the red flag laws are being used not often enough, which these studies authors also suggest, right? Now, they don't say how many red flag laws would be appropriate or how many red flag petitions would be appropriate. But the idea clearly is that more is a good thing and that high rates of disapproval is a bad thing. But it's so hard to make that kind of judgment based on statistics alone. They found, and let's go a little bit deeper here into the study. They say aggravating risk characteristics commonly occurring in cases where extreme risk protection orders were granted in 2A sanctuaries included respondents experiencing hallucinations, having a history of interaction with police, and current acute substance misuse. In several cases, though, they note, the petitioners abandoned their pursuit of extreme risk protection orders in favor of other civil restraining orders, including those that also prohibit possession of firearms. These cases were included in the analysis and are included in the accompanying series of representative cases. Now, that's hugely important, right? Because we're told all the time that red flag laws are a valuable tool for prosecutors to use. Sometimes we're told that it's a valuable tool for mental health professionals to use, even though there is generally no mental health component to a red flag law. But we're told that these things are needed, right? Because there's no other way to go about dealing with somebody who might pose a danger to themselves or others. Clearly, that's not the case. As the study's authors note themselves, there were cases, particularly in these 2A sanctuary counties, where law enforcement decided, you know what, this is not the most appropriate tool that we have in our toolbox. Let's instead use a civil commitment law. Let's get somebody, you know, in front of a mental health professional to do an evaluation. Because maybe just taking their guns away isn't going to actually solve the problem here of a dangerous person who is threatening to harm themselves or others. Which to me, by the way, seems like an eminently reasonable position to take. But again, the study's authors, that's kind of problematic, right? Because they want to see more red flag laws being used. So even if the dangerous person, even if their dangerousness is still being addressed, if it doesn't involve the use of a red flag law, which takes away the guns and leaves the dangerous person to their own devices, they view that as a negative. The authors of this study also say this cross-sectional analysis of ERPO use in Colorado highlights the utility of extreme risk protection orders. See, again, they're starting from the assumption that these things are good and valuable, and we need more of them, including in geographic areas that have made political proclamations against their use. People exhibiting an extreme risk of violence directed towards themselves, family members, partners, or groups of people are not bound by geography. No matter the political leanings of their community, our results, they say, suggest that people facing direct or ongoing threats of gun violence often elect to pursue civil protection orders in many of the types of cases for which they were designed. As other community members outside law enforcement become more involved in ERPO petitioning, including direct petitioning, they should know that local political proclamations do not necessarily limit the legal tools available to reduce the risk of gun violence. In other words, they want people living in these 2A sanctuaries to know that red flag laws are still a tool for them to use. Remember, Colorado has expanded the petitioners, the pool of potential petitioners, right? So it's not just law enforcement and family members now. Now it can be healthcare workers. Now it can be former dating partners. You know, they've expanded that body, right? Again, with an eye towards increasing the number of red flag petitions that are filed. But why? Because they blithely assume that, well, if we're taking the guns away, that's a beneficial result, right? Here's somebody who somebody has declared to be dangerous. And we've said, well, now you can't own a gun. Now, is the problem solved? For a red flag law advocate, absolutely the problem is solved, right? You've done what you set out to do. You have removed their ability to lawfully possess a firearm. For those of us who are, let's say, more interested in a holistic approach, right, that actually deals with the dangerous individual and not any one item that they might own, well, to me, this is encouraging bad behavior. It's encouraging the wrong thing. Because, again, these red flag laws don't address the underlying dangerousness. When we were talking about this last week, I think we're discussing New York State and the New York appellate court's decision to uphold the constitutionality of these red flag laws. One of the cases that I brought up was a guy in New York who had been red flagged after threatening to kill his brother and his family with an axe. Now, This guy can't legally buy a gun in New York for a period of a year or more. But he can still go into his local sporting goods store and buy a hatchet or a machete. So how has the problem been solved? How has the dangerousness of that individual been addressed in any way, shape, or form? Right? He threatened to kill his family with an axe, and the state said, well, you can't own a gun. Okay. So what happens next? And I guess if this guy doesn't kill his family with an axe or a firearm, the state would consider that to be a success story, right? But it doesn't prove that the red flag law saved anybody's life or stopped any crime. In fact, it is really impossible to measure the effectiveness of a red flag law in terms of reducing crime, in terms of reducing mass shootings, in terms of reducing suicide, because how do you measure something that hasn't happened, right? There have only been a couple of studies that have tried to take a look at this. They had to use, you know, artificial computer models. What would happen if the state hadn't enacted a red flag law? Well, we can, you know, enter in these parameters and see what the computer spits out. But I'm always suspicious of those sort of artificial analysis where you create these artificial universes. And even then, that study found that in Indiana, there was a slight reduction not only in firearm-related suicides, but overall suicides. In Connecticut, which has had its red flag law on the books since 1999, there was a slight decrease in firearm-related suicides, but that was more than made up for by an increase in non-gun-involved suicide. So the suicide rate still increased. And again, the issue really does boil down to, do you think dangerousness is a gun control problem with a gun control solution? Or do you think that somebody's dangerousness, their statements, explicit or implied, of harm towards themselves or others is an issue in and of itself? And you have to address that individual. Again, for the gun control activists, it's easy. Go after the gun, right? Don't even mention mental health. Not up front. There's no evaluation to by a psychiatrist or a mental health professional to determine whether or not somebody is dangerous. Not after the fact. After a petition has been granted and the state has ruled that somebody is a danger to themselves or others, is help provided, is counseling mandated, or even offered? No. In the vast majority of red flag states, no. They're on their own. Once that petition has been granted and the state has said, you can't own a gun anymore, that's it. The state's role is over. And now you have a dangerous person who still has access to, again, knives, axes, matches, gasoline, whatever, right? There are lots of objects that we use in our daily routine that can become dangerous weapons in the hands of a dangerous person. And red flag laws are specifically not designed to deal with those types of things that can be turned into weapons, right? That's why I know you get tired of hearing me say this, but it's the truth. Red flag laws are not mental health laws. Red flag laws are not about making somebody less dangerous. Red flag laws are a way for the gun control advocates to introduce a gun ban on the books. And once it's in place, again, the only measure of its success is the number of petitions that are filed and the number of petitions that are granted. If you have a county where there is skepticism, where the approval rates are low, that's automatically cause for alarm for the gun control advocates. Now, it could be, again, that these petitions were filed against individuals who didn't pose a danger to themselves or others. So the judge was right to say, no, get this out of my courtroom. This is ridiculous. But that doesn't matter, right? The particular circumstances of any individual don't matter. What matters are the numbers. It could even be, as the study's authors have pointed out, the law enforcement says, actually, you know what? Taking this person's guns away isn't going to solve the problem. We need to make sure that they have help, right? Even if that means, you know, intensive inpatient psychiatric treatment. Well, even that, I suppose, would be a failure, according to the red flag supporters, because the red flag law wasn't used. Now, I would say we're probably looking at a much better outcome, but not from the perspective of the anti-gunners. More red flag laws, lower reporting requirements, lower standards to approve these red flag laws. That's what they're pushing for. You know, when these things were first introduced back in the late 1990s, I've made this analogy before, but it's true. Democrats, well, supporters of these bills talked about it kind of like Democrats used to talk about abortion, right? It should be safe, legal, and rare. You know, these things would be rarely used. Only in the most extreme cases would they be used. Well, no, now you've got Governor Kathy Hochul in New York telling the state police to file red flag petitions at every given opportunity. You've got offices of, you know, gun violence prevention, not just at the White House, but at the state level as well, that are encouraging the use of red flag orders. Again, their goal is to use this tool as often as possible, even when it is not applicable, even when it is not the best way to deal with somebody who's dangerous. And certainly, even when, as in every case, these laws violate our fundamental civil rights. All right, let's turn attention now to today's armed citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. Oh, man, this one is just simply infuriating. Madison, Wisconsin, WKOW, where a plea deal has led to probation for a suspect that police say put a gun to a woman's head. Now, the woman ended up stabbing the man in self-defense in this case, it should be noted. Court records show that Terrell Cargill was convicted of criminal trespassing and disorderly conduct. Authorities say he went into the woman's apartment in Madison last May, pointed a gun at her. Prosecutors said that the woman stabbed Cargill in self-defense. But the judge in this case ended up withholding Cargill's sentence, placing him on probation for just 3 years, by the way. That's it. So no prison time for going into someone's apartment without permission. I mean, that's trespassing, burglary, home invasion, depending on how you want to look at it. I'd say home invasion since he was armed at the time. Pointed a gun at her. And who knows what would have happened had this woman not been able to act in self-defense. Now, typically when you bring a knife to a gunfight, it doesn't work out well. In this case, thankfully, the woman was able to protect herself. But now, I mean, they say justice is blind. No, I think the judge was lifting up his blindfold and peeking here a little bit, because there's no way that this is justice for the criminal activity that Mr. Cargill was convicted of, not merely accused of. This wasn't a case of, innocent until proven guilty and prosecutors not being able to meet that burden. Cargill convicted of criminal trespassing, disorderly conduct, and still managing to avoid prison after pointing a gun at a woman in her own home. Unbelievable. People's Republic of Madison, maybe, but, unfortunately, we've seen stories like this in purple and even red states as well. Speaking of a purple state, North Carolina, boy, that is going to be one to watch this fall. I think it's going to be really, really close. Not just at the presidential level, but you've got a governor's race. Josh Stein, the anti-gun Democrat attorney general, versus Mark Robinson, the pro-gun lieutenant governor. And gun owners really could have an outsized impact on that race, as well as the presidential race. According to the crime prevention research center, about 10% of North Carolina adults possess a concealed carry license, which is pretty darn good. They're closing in on 1 million. Active concealed carry license. I think Dr. Lott said as of 2022, there were almost 900,000 active concealed carry licenses in the state of North Carolina. One of them in the hands of a North Carolina man who was the victim of an attempted carjacking at a gas station in Lincolnton, North Carolina. That's I don't know if you'd call it a suburb of Charlotte, but it's maybe an exurb of Charlotte. Town of about 10,000 people. It's broad daylight. Easter afternoon, this guy's at a gas station on Main Street, and a 39-year-old, Billy Ray Galloway, allegedly approaches the man, armed with a knife, tries to steal his car. Thankfully, that man had his firearm with him as he went to the gas station on Easter Sunday. and he drew his firing one round, striking Galloway. He was taken to a local hospital. When police arrived, Galloway was still there on the scene, as was the armed citizen. The armed citizen not facing any charges. He was acting in self-defense. Galloway taken to a local hospital in Gastonia, North Carolina, treated and released, so non-life-threatening injuries. At last report, now being held without bond in a North Carolina jail on charges of attempted robbery. We'll try to follow up that story with more details as they become available. But thankfully, again, this armed citizen was able to protect and defend himself. Finally today, our good deed of the day. Also, I guess, an armed citizen story as well. Since this is going to be the last game at Company of the Week, no reason why we can't have two armed citizen stories, especially when one involves a bystander in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A good Samaritan who rescued a police officer who was trying to make an arrest. This was in Shreveport, Louisiana. It was about 11 o'clock Friday night when an officer was called out to on an obscenity report. I confess I was a little confused. Did somebody find a dirty book somewhere or an adult movie on the ground? No. When the officer arrived, according to KTAL, she found 46-year-old Rhonda Steen butt naked and causing a disturbance. So the officer in question then tried to take Steen into custody. Steen was not cooperative. At one point, the officer deployed her taser, but Steen was able to disarm the police officer. A local security guard saw what was going on and intervened, pulling his gun, firing one shot, striking Steen in the leg. The Shreveport police officer had to receive medical attention for head injuries that she received. Steen was taken to a local hospital for treatment. Again, non-life-threatening injuries, thankfully. In a statement on Monday, the Shreveport Police Department thanked the security guard for coming to the rescue of the officer, saying that the department extends its deepest gratitude to the courageous actions of the security guard, whose swift intervention undoubtedly prevented a potentially more serious outcome. So, again, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. That unnamed security guard in Shreveport, Louisiana, on hand to step in and save the day and allow that officer to hopefully recover from what were, fingers crossed, fairly minor injuries in that encounter with the naked woman who was resisting arrest. We thank you. You're very unusual, but timely and appreciated. Good deed. Now, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program. As always, as I said, I'll be off the rest of the week, but I will be back with you next Tuesday. And fingers crossed, we'll have Cody with us from Firearms Policy Coalition Action Foundation. But if that's later in the week, that's fine. I know we'll be talking to somebody who you need to hear from on the next edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. Until then, make sure you're checking out BearingArms.com to find out all of the latest news and information regarding your right to keep and bear arms. It's a busy time. We've got a lot of legislators who are starting to wrap up their sessions. A lot of bills going to desks. Thankfully, some of them are good bills. Some of them, not so much. And thankfully, as well, some are dying on the vine rather than getting to a governor's desk where they can be signed into law and impact our right to keep and bear arms. But we've got you covered on legislation, litigation, and more at BearingArms.com. I'm looking forward to seeing you back here next week. Until then, be well. Be safe. And be free.